Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey, what is up, everybody?
And welcome back to Mile Higher Podcast, episode 319. I'm your host, Kendall.
And I'm Josh.
And we are joined by our production team, Janelle and Ian.
Hey, everyone.
Hey, guys. So today we're going to be looking at a case that definitely needs more awareness, really has had very minimal coverage. It's honestly surprising, like almost no major coverage, really. And it's one that really needs it because it's unsolved to this day. It's incredibly heartbreaking and confusing. I mean, there's not a whole lot of answers.
Yeah, and it hasn't even been that long, too.
No.
2009 is when this murder happened, mm-hmm. and it seems like a very solvable case.
Yeah.
So it's still an active case, according to the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police. And I think they're just really needing just a little bit more evidence, information to help them get this to the next level where they can actually prosecute somebody for this case. Because it's an extremely tragic situation that unfolds. I mean, Noria Maya is who we're talking about today. Mm-hmm. And she seems like just an amazing, amazing individual.
Mm-hmm. Her whole family, they seem great.
Yeah, had everything going right for her.
Yeah, this was so unexpected, just completely out of the blue.
And what's
shocking.
And what's crazy about this case is this all takes place on Halloween night.
Yeah.
And I think one of the biggest factors preventing this case from being solved is the fact that it was Halloween, and she, you know, we'll get into it, but she was found in her apartment, and her apartment building has a, you know, a lot of people live in there. Over 2,000 people live in this apartment complex, mm-hmm. but it's a secured building. It has security, mm-hmm. check-in, all that kind of stuff. But because it was Halloween night, there was a lot of people coming in and out of the building dressed up in costumes and masks. Yeah. So it made it very difficult for police to figure out who exactly was coming through the building.
Yep.
And, you know, there's more details there, but
which has really got me wondering about the timing of it. Was it purposely done on Halloween for that reason?
Right. Yeah, that's a really good point. I think it's definitely something to consider. I think mm-hmm. that's one of the big questions here is this a opportunistic homicide where a situation unfolded and ultimately she was murdered because of something that happened? Or was this premeditated and carried out on Halloween night because the perpetrator knew that it was going to be very difficult to identify people going in and out of this apartment complex?
So, I kind of lean towards that, not to get too ahead of myself. But yeah, I think that whoever did this really thought it through. They were very meticulous and
definitely. Yeah. And there's definitely some other evidence found at the crime scene that suggests that mm-hmm. being the case. But, mm-hmm. but yeah, there's still not a suspect named in this case.
No.
There's been some persons of interest. There's been a lot of DNA mm-hmm. Collected, but still there's been no matches for the unknown male DNA that was found at the scene. So this is a definitely a mystery still. And I know her brother and sister are desperately hoping that something comes to light that helps get this case solved. Because I mean, them above everybody else wants to know who did this to her so that justice can be served and, you know, hopefully figure out what happened.
And
that
Yeah, I will say before we get started too, if you want to hear directly from them, they did an episode of Unsolved Mysteries podcast. Is that it's called?
Yes.
Just Unsolved, I think. It's shorter and it does leave out a lot. Like, we will be getting into much more information, but it's nice to hear directly from them, just their experience and everything. So we will have that linked below.
But we're going to give you the deep dive on this with a lot more, probably the most comprehensive coverage of this case. Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of things, there's a lot of things that just don't get mentioned. And again, there just really hasn't been that much. I think America's Most Wanted covered it.
Yeah. But then you can't even find the episode.
No, it's like scrubbed from the internet. It's been archived at this point and is just gone from the internet. Yeah, so there really hasn't been a whole lot. But we're hoping that that will change. So should we get into it?
Yeah.
All right, let's do it.
So Nori Amaya was born on September 9th, 1971 in El Salvador, and not much is known about her early life or even her parents' names, actually. We do know that her mother would remain a constant in her life, but it's unclear if her father was involved in her. But 2 years later, her brother Carlos was born, and the two of them were extremely close from a very young age. And although their mother did the best that she could to raise them, she was often out of the house to support their family. So Carlos and Nori kind of raised one another, and they have a very sweet relationship. They were really instrumental in feeding each other, keeping each other occupied, and really just each other's support system always. And while their young family was happy, life in El Salvador was very turbulent. The country had been used as a proxy in the Cold War, and tensions had really reached a boiling point. In 1977, a fake election brought Carlos Romero into power, and protesters had gathered around the Capitol following the election, and Romero's military actually opened fire on them, killing demonstrators and bystanders alike. And in 1979, Romero was killed in a military coup, and the United States and Soviet Union threw their support behind warring guerrilla groups that would then turn into a 12-year civil war. And the war ultimately killed over 75,000 civilians. So not a great place to be growing a family. Wanting to save her family from the violence, the Amayas emigrated to the United States during the El Salvadorian Civil War, and they settled in Silver Spring, Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C. Now, Silver Spring is known as a gathering point for many newly emigrated families, with enclaves for Ethiopian, Indian, and El Salvadorian people, and many other cultural communities as well. And while the Amayas were able to settle, Nori's mother worked long hours as a lab technician, and Carlos and Nori were spending most of their time with one another again. But still, they settled in pretty quick. They were able to make new friends very easily, and they were beloved in their community. Childhood friends of Nori describe her as being, quote, so nice and friendly to everyone. In high school, she worked at Nordstrom Rack, where coworkers describe her as, quote, a true sunshine. And around this time, the Amaya family was still growing. When Nori was 17 years old, her mother gave birth to her younger sister, Liz Pacheco. And once again, as Nori's mother worked to support the family, Carlos and Nori really raised their baby sister. Liz said that Carlos and Nori were, quote, her parental figures, mentors, and siblings, kind of all in one.
Yeah, it speaks volumes to their character as well.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, that's just, whenever I hear about that, I'm always just so impressed with people like that.
I know.
Not only did you immigrate to a new country and have to assimilate to living here and all of that, but you're also raising your baby sister at the same time.
Yeah, it's really impressive. I know there's so many people out there that, you know, take on that role at such a young age. It's very impressive. I agree. So with the two of them being so close, it was no surprise that they ended up attending Montgomery College together. And after graduation, Nori began managing a Days Inn in Washington, D.C. And around that same time, Carlos became interested in the restaurant industry in D.C.'s bustling U Street neighborhood, which, Ian, you said is pretty cool down there.
Yeah, U Street's very, very fun. I only went once just this past Christmas, almost a year ago, but fun as hell. I get it. If I was there and I was like, yeah, I want to.
You'd want to be there.
I'd want to be there. If I could own and operate a restaurant anywhere in the city, I'd be like, yeah, U Street's the one.
Dang, we missed out on that last time.
Yeah, where is it in relation to downtown?
I don't know. I was drunk, being led around by my ex, in a good way, in a good way. Let me be clear. But I could not tell you where it is.
Cool place regardless. I mean, I see what people like to live there. Mm-hmm. Lots of history and cool places to visit for sure.
But right around this time, Nori ended up experiencing some personal issues, some health issues. She had been suffering from these constant headaches and migraines for a few years at this point. And doctors were able to figure out that she had this cyst embedded in her brain since birth. And while it was benign, there was a fear, of course, that the cyst could rupture or cause infection and cause other serious issues. However, Nori ended up using this time to really kind of come into herself. She started getting tattoos, including a sword tattoo on her chest, and she became really well known for her vivacious and eccentric personality. When Nori met her surgeon, Zachary Levine, for the first time, she came in with a pet lizard around her neck. I just absolutely love that.
That's sick.
And he joked with her and said, quote, "Do you want to put that thing on a leash or something?" "No, sir. It's a civilized lizard."
That's awesome. Love that.
That's awesome. She just seemed like such a cool person.
As you can probably imagine, Nori ended up undergoing multiple brain surgeries to finally remove the cyst. And the recovery process was very long and very difficult. But Nori wanted to stay in the scene and engage her body. And she became very involved in DC's salsa club community. For Nori, salsa was her form of therapy. It not only engaged her body after multiple painful surgeries, but it also gave her that built-in community. And soon, she had this massive friend group, and they said that she was, quote, magnetized to the dance floor. And soon, Nori became known as the Salsa Queen. The salsa clubs were mainly located near U Street, like we mentioned, a historic neighborhood in DC known for its cultural centers like jazz clubs and buzzing dance cafes. After this, Nori's life basically revolved around the salsa clubs and the massive group of friends that she made throughout them. But even though she spent most nights out dancing, Nori still managed a hotel during the day and wanted to get more involved in Washington, DC's dance scene. That was when, in 2003, Carlos bought Copies, a neighborhood Italian restaurant out there on U Street. The restaurant was initially opened in the mid-90s, but Carlos had bought it with a vision in mind. He wanted Copies to remain strong with its Italian roots, but focus its menu on organic, locally sourced meat and produce, with an emphasis on vegetarian and vegan dishes as well. But while he focused on the menu, he needed someone to curate the restaurant's vibe and decor. Luckily, his sister was the perfect person for the job, so he called Nori, and within a week of Carlos purchasing the restaurant, the two co-owned and cooperated Copies Organic Restaurant together.
I just love that they did this together. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's rare for siblings to go into business together. So yeah. I think that also speaks to their closeness and their friendship. And they realize how each other's strengths could benefit each other, which is awesome.
Perfect team.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
So at this point, Nori had fully recovered from her brain surgery, and she managed Copies with a ton of passion. She organized salsa dancing nights, she hired belly dancers, and compiled a wine list with recommendations for any palate. According to Nori's friend, Mara Jimenez, she said, quote, "Came and kissed you and asked, what do you want? She made you feel at home." At first, the setup was perfect. Nori could run the restaurant from 5 p.m. to close and then go dancing after she got off, and Carlos would often join her. Then soon after that, Copy started sending food and clothing on relief missions to Guyana, Colombia, and El Salvador, and Nori became a fixture within DC's immigrant community. According to the Washington Post, quote, "Her round cheeks, cat-like eyes, and Mona Lisa smile gave her face an opaque warmth." And that smile would earn her the nickname Mona, which it seems like most of her friends that knew her referred to her as Mona when talking about her. She even wrote on Facebook in 2009, quote, "Hard work pays off, and I have the best business partner in the world." And she's talking about her brother, Carlos. Although Nori was known for her outspoken personality, she took the restaurant business very seriously. She fired employees if they showed up late without warning and would often be the last one in the restaurant when Carlos closed it up. And although she always had time to dance, she couldn't really have a romantic life between the restaurant and the clubs. And as the years went by, she started really wanting a loving marriage and children of her own. According to restaurant owner Martha Bedoya, Nori was, quote, "a person who always felt empty and lonely, and she didn't feel anyone she met was fit for her." Martha, who described herself as Nori's godmother, ended up getting her a dog for company. As you can imagine, in the salsa community, Nori had many potential suitors, and while she would have flings or boyfriends from time to time, she simply wouldn't have enough time to commit to them between the restaurant and dance. Because if you ever worked in the restaurant business, you know it is very, very, very busy. It's very stressful. Just a ton of work goes into running a restaurant.
Major grind.
So Nori needed to be with someone who understood that and lived a similar lifestyle.
So in 2009, when Nori turned 38, she became involved with the owner of this other club called the Roomba Cafe, which was one of Nori's favorite salsa clubs. And the man did press at the time of Nori's case first breaking, but has since just remained silent. And due to this, we will refer to him as Gus. But his full name, again, just like last week, I think it was last week, his full name is available online if you want to find it, but we're just not going to put it out there. But anyway, Gus said that Nori was, quote, exactly like me. Same problems, same business, lots of passion. And the two of them were quite happy for a while. However, throughout 2009, it became clear that Gus and Nori wanted different things out of their relationship. Gus had been married twice before with children, and although he hadn't formally divorced his second wife, the two had separated for 6 years. While Nori wanted a family and children, Gus didn't want to, you know, do it all over again for a third time with her. And just a little note here, some have reported that Gus and his ex-wife were still together during their relationship with Nori, but it seems like that's false reporting. Not totally sure there, just kind of wanted to put it out there. But anyway, Carlos, on the other hand, disapproved of Gus. He said that their relationship, quote, changed Nori, that she started arriving later and later to work and drinking more, and it was clearly hard on her, taking a toll on Nori. And on paper, Gus seemed to be kind of the perfect man for her. I mean, he was in the same business. They did live those similar lifestyles the way that she was looking for. Not to mention that the two of them were both well-known in the salsa community, but he simply couldn't commit. And that's what Nori wanted during this time in her life, someone that was willing to commit and really start a family with her. And on top of that, things were getting kind of strange with Gus's separated wife. Even though the two of them had been separated for 6 years and maintained an amicable friendship, she had apparently called copies. An employee picked up and she asked to speak with Nori, claiming to be, quote, Gus's wife. And the employee informed her that Nori was not in the restaurant that day, and then this woman just hung up. But the call kind of scared Gus and made him wonder, quote, who's playing such stupid games? So after months of non-commitment from Gus, Nori decided to call it quits with him. She needed something serious, someone who was a little bit more stable, ready to take the path in life that she wanted, especially as her life was currently getting harder and harder to handle. Nori had spent one night with her friend Celia, the owner of Cafe Citron, and they were drinking wine together at the cafe, and Nori was just crying, saying, quote, that the restaurant is going to kill me, it's too much stress, and Celia told her to leave it. Copies wasn't worth this amount of stress, but Nori said that she couldn't leave the restaurant because it would mean leaving her brother alone with it. And I totally get that. That's a really tough place to be in. And Celia said, quote, I can't forget the look on Nori's face. It was like, help me. And of course, something else that was adding to Nori's stress too was the fact that she still had feelings for Gus, even though she was the one that ended the relationship. It was a tough call. It needed to happen, but obviously, there was a lot of emotional baggage from the breakup. And not only that, she also needed someone to confide in. And normally, she would have gone to Gus. And what she needed to confide in someone about was the fact that a CT scan had discovered a lump on the back of her head 10 years after the surgery had removed that benign cyst from her brain. And at this point, they didn't know if it was malignant or benign, so Nori was worried that she would have to undergo surgery once again. And this all led up to Halloween of 2009. Now, for Nori, Halloween was one of her favorite nights to go out dancing. She often spent months getting really into her costume, designing it, putting together these really elaborate outfits for the night. And this year, Halloween 2009, she just simply didn't have it in her. I mean, she was going through so much stress between the breakup with Gus and now the lump on the back of her head, and everything that she was putting into the restaurant all the time was just really taking a toll on her. So she didn't really have the, you know, time or energy to put much into the costume for the night out. But Carlos knew how much his sister loved Halloween, and he wanted her to go out and have fun like always. So he ended up tearing apart this old Venetian mask in his house and attached feathers to it, giving it to her at the restaurant that night, which just broke my heart thinking about what ends up happening, but really shows you what an amazing brother he is. But anyway, the two of them worked together at Copies that night until 10 when it closed, and then they ended up sharing a bottle of Nori's favorite wine together and had dinner. at the bar like they always did after they worked a long shift together. And Nori didn't have any set plans for that evening. She was planning on kind of bouncing between some of her favorite salsa clubs before ending the night at Bravo Bravo, where she would meet with her longtime dance partner, a man named Iz, which again isn't his full name and it's out there, but recent reporting just kind of leaves him unnamed.
Carlos almost always joined Nori, especially on Halloween, but he had a party he was invited to and told her that he would try to meet her later, but he would likely be too tired and would probably just head home afterwards. So the two of them finished their bottle of wine and then said their goodbyes. After dinner, Nori first stopped by the Russian Room, a club on DuPont Circle. And not much is known about her time there, except that she met some people from her large salsa dance friend group. Nori danced and drank there for a few hours until she left around midnight and then headed over to the Roomba Cafe, which, if you remember, is Gus's club.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Gus was working that night, but the two were friendly. Nori said hello before she joined her friends on the dance floor. She danced for a while longer, but thought that Gus was avoiding her. So she went over and approached Gus and asked him to sit with her, and he said he was working. It's unknown what they spoke about, but whatever it was, it made Nori quite upset. Gus said, quote, "Maybe she was upset with me." Nori then left the Roomba Cafe around 1:30 a.m. on November 1st without saying goodbye to Gus. Her friend said she was crying and could see tears streaming down her face underneath her Venetian mask. Nori then arrived at Bravo Bravo downtown at around 1:45 a.m., where she met with her dance partner, Iz. However, Nori was still distraught. She said hello to Iz but didn't dance, and then only 15 minutes later, she announced that she was going to head home. Iz told her, quote, "Where are you going? We just got here." At around 2 a.m., Iz was seen on Bravo Bravo security footage escorting Nori into a taxi. The two said their goodbyes, and then the cab sped off. Nori is seen on CCTV entering her apartment complex, the Woodner, at around 2:30 a.m. She spoke to the security guards up front for a few minutes before taking the elevator to her 11th floor apartment. Nori would never leave her apartment again. On the morning of November 1st, 2009, Carlos was at Copy's preparing for a 100-person party that he and Nori were scheduled to work. Carlos received a phone call from the taxi driver Nori had taken the night before, letting him know that she had left her phone in the backseat of his taxi. This was not unusual for Nori. She was known for being forgetful at times, often leaving behind her phone, her keys, or her wallet. And this was actually a symptom of the brain surgeries that she had undergone 10 years earlier. The cab driver proceeded to drop off Nori's phone at Copy's, and Carlos continued to prepare for that huge party that they had planned without a sign of Nori whatsoever. This was also not that unusual. Although Nori took the restaurant business very seriously, there had been a few times that she had, you know, gone overboard, had a little too much fun the night before, and then needed to, you know, sleep off a hangover or just recoup before the day ahead. So he was like, you know, maybe that's what happened. And it's Halloween, right? So, I mean, a lot of people go hard on Halloween. But she would always call Carlos in advance if that's what she was planning to do. But he didn't expect any communication from her since she didn't have her phone. She had left it in the cab. Carlos ended up working the party and then headed over to Nori's to check on her. The security guards at the front desk recognized him and led him into the elevator to go upstairs to check on Nori. He got off on the 11th floor, then walked over to Nori's door. Her door was locked and he couldn't hear any noises coming from inside. So he opened the mail slot on the door and looked inside. Carlos said that the apartment was very dark and that he felt a, quote, gush of air hitting his face. But still, if Nori was resting from Halloween, he didn't want to disturb her. So he ended up leaving the Woodner and headed back over to Copy's. On Monday, November 2nd, Copy's had no scheduled events and Carlos arrived at the restaurant around its regular opening time of 5 p.m. At this point, Carlos was definitely concerned. He could understand Nori missing the prior day, as it was a large party and perhaps she just wasn't up for it, but Copy's had nothing scheduled on the 2nd, and she would have had plenty of time by this point to sleep off a hangover or recuperate. Carlos then called their younger sister, Liz Pacheco, who met him at Copy's before the two of them drove back over to Woodner. Carlos and Liz then went back up to the 11th floor and knocked on Nori's door once more. The door was still locked, and when they peered through the mail slot, it was just as dark and silent as the day before. Now they were very, very worried that something was wrong. Carlos and Liz then returned to the lobby and spoke to the security guard, and they explained to him that Nori had not been seen nor heard from in the past 2 days and wanted to access her apartment to make sure she was okay inside. So the security guard agreed to help them get into her apartment. He grabbed the master key, and all three of them went back up to the 11th floor. Liz was the last to enter the apartment, and she flipped the light switch on. And that's when they saw Nori's Halloween clothes in a bundle near the front door, as if she had taken them off the moment she came home. Then they saw her bed. A sheet covered Nori's body, but her hair and left hand were hanging underneath the covers. Carlos looked at the security guard before he approached her, saying Nori's name over and over again. Carlos then grabbed Nori's toe and shook it, but there was no response. Then he removed the sheet, revealing that Nori was only wearing her underwear, and her skin was blue, and there were marks around her neck. Carlos then put his hands to his head and said, quote, "No, no, no, no."
I can't even imagine how traumatic this would be. Listening to them speak about this on the Unsolved podcast was just heart-wrenching. I cannot imagine being in that position.
Well, and also think Carlos was there the day before.
Yeah.
And thinking like, oh my God, was she already dead when I was there the other day and I didn't do anything and I didn't go in?
Just didn't know.
Liz said that, quote, "Someone tore right through me." And she thought that if she could touch Nori, she would just wake up. Liz put her hand on Nori's skin and said, quote, "I've never felt something that cold before. Ice and snow were warmer." Liz and Carlos held each other, and they ended up on the floor crying. Carlos felt like he couldn't breathe. At around 9:11 p.m. on November 2nd, D.C. police responded to a call from the security guard and were on scene shortly afterward.
I do think, like, whenever we talk about, like, a body being found, mm-hmm. oftentimes it's found by a neighbor, it's found by investigators, it's found by some. It's very rarely, at least in my time since, like, working here with you guys, mm-hmm. it's very rare that it's the family themselves who find it. And so, like, yeah, I think, like, that alone, I couldn't imagine that.
It's so traumatizing. In our documentary we just did this year, I don't know, did you end up watching mm-hmm. that? Yeah, I'm sure you heard Audrey's story of finding her sister's body and just what a toll that has taken on her. Yeah, I really cannot imagine what that would be like. Be horrendous.
Well, and just the thoughts that are going through your head, she's obviously deceased, and the next thought is, well, what happened? And then you start running scenarios through your head. Mm-hmm. Was she murdered? Did she take her own life? And obviously for them, I think they went to murder straight away because they knew Nori, you know? Mm-hmm. So they were like, somebody murdered her. And then you start thinking about all the possibilities, and it's just unimaginable.
And that's something that they like have had to continue wondering about. I mean, how can you not think about what exactly happened that night? What went down? Who did this? How did it happen? What were her last moments like? You know, that's just beyond traumatic to face for years and years and years. So veteran DC Metro Detective Tony Patterson was assigned to the case and arrived at the apartment shortly after the security guard put in the call. And Tony first noticed that the apartment was still in order. No one had torn through a dresser or any other compartments within it. This was certainly not a robbery. Tony observed the ligature marks around Nori's neck and determined that she was strangled with a single ligature, and the assailant likely used something to kill Nori, and that she was not strangled with their bare hands. Lori had some bruising and scratching just below her lip. There was contusion marks on her arms as if someone were trying to kneel on her and prevent her from defending herself. And the next thing that was noticed was very disturbing. Nori was always known for having very long, beautiful fingernails, and Detective Patterson and Liz both noticed that Nori's fingernails had been removed, like basically cut down to the quick. So it's assumed that she likely scratched the assailant, which would have preserved some of their DNA underneath her nails, and that the perpetrator was smart enough to remove them after they killed her. However, even though they seemed to be trying to be as careful as they could to not leave anything behind, DNA evidence was luckily left behind at the scene. Police have not made it public what kind of evidence this was, whether it was blood, hair, potentially even semen, but it was from an unknown male, and it was left on her body.
I was going to also say you're probably wondering, well, do they know what the ligature marks are from? And they don't. They actually did a full search of the apartment, and the only thing they found was a single USB cable. And I believe they had that tested, but there is no DNA on it whatsoever. Right. So most likely the killer took that with them.
Yeah.
Because it's very obvious. I mean, I'm sure that was kind of out in the ordinary for somebody to clip the fingernails of the victim.
Yeah.
Or cut them off. And you don't see that very often.
No.
So that's kind of a...
I don't think I've ever seen that in any of the cases that I've covered.
Yeah.
That I can remember.
That's kind of unusual.
Mm-hmm. After Nori was determined to have been killed in the early morning hours of November 1st, just after she had gotten home from the clubs, police began tracking her movements the rest of that night on Halloween. They spoke to her friends, namely Gus, who learned about Nori's death from the police interview. And they confirmed his alibi. Gus remained at the Roomba Cafe until it closed around 2 a.m. before he fell asleep in the apartment that he owned just above the club. And they also collected DNA samples from Gus and his ex-wife as well, and neither of them matched with the unknown samples that were left on Nori's body. But Gus's ex-wife denied calling copies and asking for Nori, that one strange call. And Gus seems to believe her. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I personally think we'll get into a little bit more, but if it's someone else attempting to throw suspicion, it would make sense to be like, well, she has this relationship with Gus, who's pretty well known. If it's someone in their friend group, he's very well known in their friend group. And if they want to throw suspicion towards him or his quote, like crazy ex-wife, just have someone call copies and pretend to be here. Because from all accounts that Gus gave, again, he's going to be biased in this, they had an amicable, nice relationship and, co-parented their children together. And there would be no indication that, 6 years separated, she would suddenly be like, I am Gus's wife.
Very strange. I agree. And it kind of lends to the idea that this was pre-planned and planned meticulously, if
definitely,
that's true.
Definitely. Seems like somebody's trying to frame Gus or Gus's wife or something.
Yeah.
In this case. Because the other interesting thing too is there was no forensics as far as fingerprints found.
Nothing.
Other than that male DNA, there was absolutely nothing. So the scene was very, very clean.
Yeah.
Despite a violent attack that took place. So, which is also kind of surprising too, because why clip the fingernails? Because obviously the fingernails could have picked up DNA, but it's surprising there was no blood or any other DNA found at the scene. Because if there was in this type of attack, there would have been a struggle and maybe she scratched the individual, but maybe they were, all completely clothed top to bottom, gloves, had everything. So there was no way for blood or other DNA to fall. There's no hair. There's no, there's nothing. It's virtually a clean scene.
Yeah.
Minus the unknown male DNA. But again, we don't know what that is. And I think if we knew what that is, it might lend a little bit more clues to who potentially did this.
I'm curious if they've purposely not put that out there, or it's just something that they haven't felt the need to mention, or I don't know. It's kind of strange it's not public.
I think among another piece of DNA, I think the reason they haven't said what it was is because knowledge of what it would be incriminating. And so they're kind of saving that. They want to let the public know, that way they know that they're just not working with nothing here. But knowledge of what that actual piece of DNA evidence would be would end up being incriminating. So if someone just accidentally said did you test that blood that was on her, and then they'd be like, okay, this is our guy.
Okay, yeah, that actually makes total sense. Gus also took and passed a polygraph test and testified before a grand jury looking into the case, and at one point an investigator actually screamed at him, quote, you did it, even though police had never considered him a suspect. And there wasn't a lot of information available about that whole scenario playing out. It's very strange. We don't know if that was said in front of the grand jury or when he was being interrogated. No idea, but very unprofessional and strange. They also interviewed Iz, the last person that she spoke to before she returned home at 2:30 a.m. And he also gave a DNA sample to police, and they confirmed his alibi from CCTV footage from Bravo Bravo, which was the last club that Nori went to on Halloween. However, when asked if he had a key to Nori's apartment, Iz lied and said he didn't. He and Nori were very close, and the security guards at the Woodner wouldn't have been suspicious if he had entered. So just something to note. And it's due to that lie about having the key, while Iz himself is not a suspect, that Detective Patterson believes that he knows more than he's let on, which is hard to say. I can sort of see why I can see why someone would think to lie because they don't want to be considered or worried that they're going to get framed for something. But it's a weird thing to lie about.
Yeah, if you got nothing to hide, then you have nothing to worry about.
Mm-hmm. But in a panic, I mean, people do things like that.
Totally.
I also think it's important that a lot of the people involved in this are first generation immigrants. Yeah. And so dealing with police is not always your instinct is to lie and just end the interaction as fast as possible, even if you don't have anything to hide.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point.
And especially the fact that he's the last person to speak to her before.
He knows that doesn't look good.
Yeah.
But who knows? But it is interesting that Detective Patterson believes that he knows more. And I'm curious what else Detective Patterson may know that would lead him to think that. So just something to note. But one of the other crucial individuals is an unknown man who worked at one of the clubs that Nori visited on Halloween. And within days of her death, he left the country and returned to Argentina because his father had died and he wanted to go home and bury him. However, this was very suspicious to Detective Patterson. He and other DC police officers ended up flying out to Argentina, questioned him, and gathered his DNA, but he also was not a match. The police also just pored over the CCTV footage from the Woodner from Halloween until Carlos and Liz discovered Nori's body on November 2nd. And the Woodner is not only DC's largest apartment complex, housing around 2,000 people, like we mentioned earlier, but it's also one of the most secure. I guess there's only one entrance into the lobby, which is manned by security guards 24/7. And there are two security cameras, one facing the entrance and one out in the lobby. Residents would have to scan their key cards at the front door before scanning in again to enter their apartments. Visitors would get buzzed in, and if they entered alone, they were forced to sign a visitor sheet with security guards once they confirmed with the residents that they actually knew this person. However, like we mentioned in the beginning of the episode, looking through the security footage didn't really help much at all because Nori was likely killed on Halloween, and many people seen on the CCTV footage were wearing costumes, many of them were wearing masks, and there were no cameras in the hallways once you left the lobby.
I think that's really interesting because I'm sure they were able to go back and find, they were able to find her entering Woodner. So it sounds like she entered alone. And so then they're looking for during the time afterwards, and there's just all these people that are most being unidentifiable because of the costumes.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if there's anybody that, because it's hard to imagine every single person was caught in a costume or masked
everyone,
up.
It was a lot of people.
So out of those people, I wonder how many of them they actually looked at, were able to identify, and maybe followed up with. But again, we just don't know.
Well, it's got to be so many people.
It's Halloween night. So it's just, there's probably more people out later than usual.
Yep.
And also, I'm sure people were throwing, parties there. We're all going to meet up here and then we're going to leave. Yep. There's just more people than normal who don't live there that are coming and going.
Right. Yeah.
But I'm curious, I would hope they went and checked, the visitor logs and looked at all that. But again, it could just be this long list of people. And where do you start? It's like a needle in a haystack. So
yeah,
makes it difficult.
I really do think that this was purposely done on Halloween.
Definitely could be. I mean, seems like the prime opportunity to do this. And especially if you're really, really trying hard not to get caught, which it really seems like the killer definitely was doing that. And did this person have help too? You know what I mean? We don't even know if that it was one individual or multiple individuals. We have no idea.
All we know is there's one source of DNA, but that's possible. Unlikely though, I would think.
Well, I have kind of a theory that I'll propose here in a little bit. But,
okay.
But as you can imagine, police were unable to identify anyone of interest from the security footage, but they did learn that one person entered Nori's apartment on November 2nd, an exterminator, so a pest control person who had treated her apartment. The exterminator said that he entered the apartment and thought it was empty when he treated it. It's unclear, though, if he entered the bedroom. So at this point, she is deceased. And how on earth does this exterminator not run across her and is the one to report her?
I know.
That is baffling to me. Like,
I feel the same way.
Very weird.
Very, very weird.
In an apartment, too?
I know.
Like, you're going to treat an apartment and you don't happen to, like, walk past the bedroom. And even then, if you... he didn't notice there was a body in the bed, whether that person's alive or dead. Why are you there? Why didn't you try to make contact with the person? Be like, hey, I'm here to do your pest control.
Yeah.
It's very odd that you just entered and did it as well. Maybe that was like a... Most of the times, pest control people won't just come into your place, though. Like,
well, they could have had some type of rearranged thing. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, a lot of times apartments be like, hi, guys, between the hours of four and whatever.
Yeah,
you know, that's people are going to come in. So lock up your dogs or whatever, you know.
Yeah, that's actually probably what happened with this. But still, how did this person not see her in the bed?
Especially with her arm like hanging out.
Yeah.
You know, it's... And wouldn't they treat her bedroom as well?
I wonder what kind of treatment they were doing, because a part of me was like, okay, were they walking around and like spraying, you know, how people do that? Or was it something where they already have traps set up, maybe just in the kitchen or something like that, and they just go in and they're like changing a filter, you know, something like that?
Could have been.
I don't know.
Or they saw her
and
freaked out and didn't say anything because
they were
they're afraid of being, you know, being framed for it.
Yeah, that's possible,
too. I feel like it looks worse that this person did not say anything.
My theory about it is that the exterminator is not, not to cast aspersions, but might not be just good at their job. Like, they might just be going into the apartments, not actually treating them, just going into them, and he's like, oh, there's no one here?
Yeah.
I'm good.
Yeah.
And then just leave.
Yeah. I don't see anything. So,
yeah.
Just who knows how quickly they're going in and out of 2,000 apartments potentially.
When they talked to the exterminator, they said that he entered the apartment and thought it was empty when he treated it. And it's unclear if he entered the bedroom, but police took DNA from him anyways. And when it came back, it was not a match. After taking DNA from at least 10 people and interviewing Gus, and is four times each, DC police found no suspects in the murder of Nori Amaya. Carlos and Liz believed it must have been someone in her friend group who did it. Nori had plenty of potential suitors. Perhaps it was someone she knew, or maybe there's something that she did to somebody that would have caused them to want to harm her, possibly.
Perhaps like rejected somebody.
Yeah, that's what it kind of seems like. Perhaps they went to her apartment without the intention of killing her, but then, you know, something happened. And they did end up killing her, and they were just trying to cover their tracks. Carlos still placed a lot of suspicion on Gus, even though the police had cleared him and his ex-wife, which how can you not? I totally understand why Carlos is so suspicious of Gus.
I get that too.
Logically, there's a lot of motive and reason there.
Yeah, but there's not any real solid evidence that we're aware of, you know, that would make me agree with that. But I see where he's coming from as her brother, you know?
They also considered that maybe someone in the friend group hired a professional to carry out Nori's murder. Because again, the removal of her fingernails is likely something that a trained killer would think about and not so much the average person would think about. Because again, it's kind of unusual. We don't hear about that happening a whole lot.
And I think them removing the fingernails tells us pretty clearly that this was pre-planned and was really thought through. I just think the chances of someone doing this on a whim, like, just went wrong with her that night, and then thinking that clearly in such a chaotic moment to do something like that seems very unlikely.
Well, and I even think about the murder weapon here too. I feel like in a lot of cases of murders, you know, that happen because of a situation that just kind of unfolds, it's usually a kitchen knife, a random object, or you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, maybe they're armed and they have something with them. But a ligature, you know, I feel like when I hear ligatures, I think of serial killers. I think of people who do this a lot or have thought about and looked up, like, what are the best weapons used to kill somebody without leaving evidence?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where my brain goes, is like, this was well thought out, or this is somebody who's done this before, potentially.
Like, what are the chances it was just a random heat of the moment type situation, and they they pulled something like that together within the apartment and they weren't able to find anything that was missing that could tell them what potentially was used as a ligature.
But again, it's also possible that they just grabbed something that was like laying in the apartment and then used it to kill her and then just took it with them.
Could have been something.
You know what I mean?
Her family didn't even know was there.
Maybe,
it was missing. Yeah.
Maybe some, you know, an encounter just went south and this person was angry, grabbed something they saw lying on the ground, a cord or something, and then used that and then took it with them.
Yeah.
And then maybe that person knew that she scratched him and so thinking of, I got to take this with me and just manage to take it. Maybe it was just, you know, somebody who thought through before leaving, is there any way that they're going to trace this back to me? But again, that's a lot to think through.
It seems unlikely.
Unusual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then we have to go back to the DNA evidence that was left. Again, we don't know the source of that DNA, but it wasn't completely a clean scene. You know, you can speculate on what kind of DNA that was. It seems like, you know, looking at the whole picture here, she was found in her underwear, her clothes were off. So it seems like some type of either sexual assault that played out here, or somebody followed her back and then entered shortly after she got in and undressed and then tried to take advantage of her. So possibly there was some type of sexual assault that took place. But again, we just don't know. Or it could have been blood or hair or something else. But it's also possible that the killer planted random DNA at the scene to further throw off suspicion from themselves, which to me would, this is definitely premeditated, planned out very, very well, but also it speaks to possibly somebody with experience and knowledge on how to do this and do it without getting caught. So a lot of possibilities here. But Detective Patterson believed that the killer had to have been someone who knew Nori. Often hired killers don't care about how the body is left. And in Nori's case, whoever killed her covered her body with a sheet. And, you know, a lot of law enforcement will say this happens at scenes when, you know, it's somebody that they know. And then after they murder them, they don't want to see what they've done, essentially. And so they'll cover the body with, you know, clothing, a sheet or something else so they don't have to look at it. But I don't even know if that was necessarily the case here, because maybe it was just to just conceal the body to hope that it isn't found for, you know, a longer period of time or something. But that it is a point worth considering, I think. I think it's definitely possible this was somebody close to her. Because again, the person potentially knew about Gus, knew about her whole situation, so that would make sense. But 15 years after her death, there are no leads in the murder of Nori Amaya. Hundreds of people attended her funeral at Gate of Heaven Cemetery in Silver Spring, and friends and family posted remembrances on her Facebook page saying, quote, "Nori, I had the pleasure of knowing you for years and am better to have had you in my life." End quote. "Nori, I had the joy of knowing you. I always admire the way you cope with obstacles in life. I will miss you and I will always remember you." Now, what's interesting is that Gus and Iz attended Nori's funeral. Gus went up to Carlos even and offered to help in any way that the family needed, and Carlos responded, quote, "I don't need anything from you." Gus ended up leaving the funeral early, and Carlos followed him out. After Nori's death, her sister Liz took over her role at Copies, and in 2017, Gus's club, Roomba Cafe, closed. And in 2020, Copies closed due to the pandemic, and it's unclear if there are plans to reopen it. But Liz has high hopes that they will find the answers to her sister's murder. Carlos believes that someone in Nori's friend group is holding back answers because they killed her. And he hopes, quote, that they're living a horrible life, because he talks about how he thinks about how he may have come face to face with her killer before. And
or even potentially at her funeral.
Yeah. And that it's a horrible, horrible situation to think about another human being could do that to you, you know.
I don't know how you
especially
would ever
someone you know
trust anyone again. Yeah.
Somebody you considered a friend even.
Yeah.
And they withhold this information to cover their own ass. But
yeah, he had talked about in that episode of Unsolved how he thinks about it, like obviously makes him very angry thinking about how this person is just like, oh, I got away with it. You know, I cannot imagine the anger you would deal with on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. But according to some, Carlos still conducts his own investigation, questioning anyone he can about their involvement. And for Detective Tony Patterson, Nori's case still haunts him to this day. He has her reward poster actually still hanging up in his office. And as of 2021, Nori's case was not sent to cold cases, so it's still very much active. However, let's talk about crime in Washington, D.C., because I think this is also a factor, especially if we consider the possibility that maybe this was a crime of opportunity. Somebody saw her leave, saw that she was intoxicated possibly after a night out or had been even stalking her throughout the night. You know, it's a growing problem in Washington, D.C. Only 75 of the 244 homicides committed in the nation's capital were cleared by the end of the year. So their solving rate's definitely not very high. But in 2021, this is kind of interesting and also makes me feel a little less confident in the DNA analysis done in this case. So D.C.'s crime lab lost its accreditation due to flaws in its analysis, which is crazy, which probably lends to why the solve rate is so low as well when it comes to homicide. So it makes me wonder if they were to send the DNA samples that they have and this unknown male DNA to a different lab, if there would be a different result. Because it's kind of crazy. Like, out of all, like in most cases, you're lucky to even get a DNA sample from somebody.
Yeah.
But they have 10 different people who are closely connected to Nori in some way, and none of them. And yet, Detective Patterson's like pretty adamant that he believes this was somebody that knew her. So it makes me wonder, is there issues at the crime lab? And could there have been something that went wrong over there, or wasn't processed correctly, and maybe send this off to somewhere else and see if you get different results? But I don't know. There's just something about that just doesn't sit right with me. However, the police have indicated that there is one piece of evidence from Nori's murder that has not been publicly released yet. As we mentioned earlier, knowledge of it would be incriminating. So I wonder what that is.
Yeah, I wonder too.
Would not be incriminating. So it's got to be something.
No, I said would be incriminating.
It seems like whatever it was is likely an object of Nori's that was taken from the apartment that neither Carlos nor Liz knew about, but the police were able to figure out from her friends, there's an object that Nori had that was secret from most other people, and whoever knows about this thing is the one who stole it.
How do you know that?
That was just from an interview with the producer for the Unsolved Mysteries podcast when he was talking to police about it.
Wow, I wonder what that could possibly be.
That is kind of like the master key in this entire thing, potentially. Like, if someone is able to say like this, like, oh yeah, Nori's blah blah blah, then they're like, oh, this is our guy. Same thing with the DNA. If the person's like, oh, the blood that you found on Nori, then they would be like, okay, this guy knows, this is the guy.
Wow. God, I wonder what that could be. Huh.
Also, like, coming to mind for me is, I go back to the cab driver. I wonder about the cab driver. He picked her up, and he would obviously have known she was intoxicated. You know, she had a long night out. Drives her to where she stays. Is it possible the cab driver then like walked her up to her room? But I feel like they would know his name. They would have checked.
Well, they would have seen on CCTV if she walked in with anybody.
Yeah.
Unless they followed her up later.
I do believe also that, even though it wasn't stated, I do believe he was one of the people who was interviewed, because again, Carlos had his phone number because he had contacted him about the lost phone. So
I think most people go to is possibly, you know, he was the last person to see her, but then again, he sent her home in a cab. So
yeah,
or this was, they did get somebody to do this for them, and for what reason, I'm not sure. And that's the difficult thing, is I'm like, where's the motive here? You know what I mean? Like, unless there's more to the romantic relationships going on here, you know what I mean? There's more that we just don't know about. I feel like there's definitely more to the relationships with the people she was close with than what has been released, for sure. There's always is.
I agree too. I really want to know why Carlos seemed to dislike Gus so much, even before any of this happened. I feel like there's a lot more to that whole story here that hasn't been released.
Another thing I think worth considering, this goes back to Carlos's suspicion towards Gus, is Gus was a business owner. You know, it was kind of a messy relationship. He's separated from his wife. And I don't know. I don't know if there's enough of a motive there, but could he have had the means to find somebody to do this for him possibly? I think it's worth considering because it's very interesting to me that there's all this DNA testing done. There's no matches to anybody.
I just don't get what would the point of that be? What would the motive?
I don't know. Maybe we don't even know the motive. Maybe there's something else in this case that we just don't know about that would explain that. Because I don't know. Yeah, it seems like a very
lot of missing pieces here.
But then again, I also consider this being possibly even more random. I mean, it's Halloween night. She's out late. She's alone. Could there have been some? I mean, for all we know, there could have been some stranger hanging out in the, you know, outside of the apartment and walked in with her, and you know what I mean, who was completely concealed,
like walked in after her.
Yeah, you know what I mean, and took advantage of that night to find a victim, and then proceeded to go upstairs with her and.
It could be. I don't know. I think I don't know. Just again, going back to everything I've already said a million times now, that, you know, it just really seems like this was premeditated, pre-calculated. I think even being on Halloween was calculated, but just also the fact that Detective Patterson feels like it was someone who knew her, that I think says a lot as well. And it seems that her family feels that way too.
Do we know if it was a deadbolt that was locked, or was it just one of those?
So the door would have also had a deadbolt lock on it. I'm not sure if that was locked. It was a fob, like a key card scan, and yeah. Then you could also engage a deadbolt. Yeah. But I don't believe the deadbolt was engaged.
Well, if that's the case, that would make things a lot more complicated, because it, I'm assuming, takes an actual key to do that, and like, yeah. Where did that person get it?
Well, and I don't know, that brings me to what I think is that, like, you know, Iz had a key to her apartment. Yeah. He had a fob.
Mm-hmm.
Who else, you know, could potentially have one that the security guards wouldn't really care, you know?
Yeah.
If they just entered and came on up, especially if they're in a mask, they're not really checking. As long as they were able to scan the front door to get in.
Exactly.
Chances are the security guards aren't going to stop them, yeah. You know?
Because could he have given it to somebody else?
He could have, yeah. Or again, maybe Nora just had a couple and like it, some of yeah. her closest friends just she would give them to, you know?
Or someone just slipped in and knocked on her door and she opened it. I mean, so many different things could happen.
Right.
There are so many unanswered questions in this. I keep going back to the exterminator too. That's really bothering me. It's so bizarre. He didn't see her. He went in there and didn't see it. That's just like, I almost just don't believe it.
Right.
I mean, we went through all the ways that it could be possible, but really? I don't know.
It's hard to believe that he wouldn't have yeah. looked in the room.
Right? That's so strange.
Or like, you're going into people's apartments, you're not going to see if anybody's in there at all. Like, that's strange as well.
Ugh.
Like, I feel like when we've lived in apartments, like, maintenance people usually make themselves known. Like, oh, yeah. they're just like yeah. walking in.
Well, it's, you know, a danger, I mean? To them to just be like,
yeah.
People be like, wait, you're an intruder. So, yeah, exactly. They usually are like, hey, maintenance.
Right.
Yeah, which no one would have answered. And then they thought it right. was empty, but. It's so weird. I know we went over possible scenarios and some of those make sense. It's just, I don't know. There's so many off things here. I wish that Unsolved Mysteries would go do a full on episode and use some of their resources to really like dig into some of this. But
could it have been,
could be damaging to the case. I don't know.
That the maintenance guy came in, didn't see her at first, was doing the treatment or whatever, and then saw just someone on the bed and was like, oh fuck, like if this person is sleeping or not, like let me get the hell out of here. I'm not trying to scare them, and like didn't even think like,
yeah,
oh that's weird, let me go check on the person, and more so was like, oh crap, I caught them at a weird time or yeah. something, let me leave.
Wouldn't they have said that to police though? Yeah. And then I noticed someone was right. in there and I thought they were alive and yeah. sleeping, you know?
Well, they could have. That's the thing, is we don't know
exactly. We don't know the full yeah. extent of the yeah. interview yeah. they did.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I don't know. Maybe
we're
there
doing
is
a
some.
Lot of speculating here, but again, because there's just a lot of missing information.
But I just go back to the DNA. I, you know, if this crime lab is sound and this is like good DNA testing that's going on, we're talking about a bunch of you know, bad matches. There's no or negative mm-hmm. matches here. So
it makes you wonder about other cases too.
But then it also makes me wonder, was DNA planted at the scene to throw off police, which is wild, because then I feel like the level of skill mm-hmm. continues to go up, you know yeah. what I mean, if they you know, literally left no trace. So it's either they left no trace or the person who did this is just unidentified at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the only two options that we have.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm curious to know what police have. And
I could see so many potential theories playing out too. Yeah, I'm really curious to see what our audience thinks, mm-hmm. what you guys lean most towards.
But yeah, there is a $25,000 reward for information that leads to an arrest in the murder of Nori Amaya. If you have any information about Nori's case, you can contact the Metropolitan DC Police Department at 202-645-9600, or you can text a tip to police at 50411. But yeah.
What a heartbreaking case. After everything that she had been through in her life.
I know. Such a success
story. Escaping the violence and then
brain surgeries.
Yeah.
And it's really, really sad. And
she just seemed like such a cool person. It's horrific.
Yeah. I hope they catch whoever did this, because this, I feel like it's definitely a solvable case. They're just, I feel like they're missing one little piece.
Or they have things. Together. We just don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
Really tough.
But yeah, obviously, let us know your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think happened? We'd be curious to see. But we're gonna go ahead and wrap up today's episode there. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Mile Higher. We'll see you guys next time. Until then,
keep on taking your mind to Mile Higher.